Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. My name is Paul Edwards and I'm in Miami, Florida, and it's a pleasure to welcome all of you to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to thank myself and perhaps others for doing the recording this evening, and would also like to thank Chrissy and whoever else at ACB Radio is able to edit this chaos into a usable radio program. And of course, we'd like to thank George Byes at Talking Communities for making the software available to us that allows ACB Radio to produce programs like this one. Tonight, we have another innovation for Tuesday Topics in that for the first time we are actually going to have two guests in the first half of our program. Our topic is one that's certainly gotten a lot of attention over the past several months as a result of the hurricanes last autumn, and it's one that I obviously have a vested interest in that two hurricanes went directly over my house last fall. And that subject is emergency preparedness. We're going to be talking with two people. The first one is Doug Hall, who is the chair of the Environmental Access Committee for the Florida Council of the Blind and represented ACB, FCB, and the Division of Blind Services here in Florida at a recent national conference that was held on emergency preparedness and people with disabilities in the Tampa area. So we want Doug to report to us a little bit on what the state of the game is and what the thinking is nationally on some of the kind of hot-button issues with regard to access for people with disabilities. And our second guest is Day Al-Mohammed, who is the Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Council of the Blind and who recently has been the author of a couple of documents relating to emergency preparedness, one directly related to dogs and one more general document, which has received widespread good reviews throughout the disability community and should make a huge difference for the ability of communities to understand the needs of people who are blind. And I think that I'm actually going to start with Day, and I'm going to ask her a hard question right up front, and that is, did you get any evidence in the national office, Day, last fall after the hurricanes happened, that perhaps our nation wasn't in the best shape that it could be with regard to dealing with disabilities and emergency preparedness?
Oh, definitely. I think that was one of the things that kind of disturbed us more than anything else was, out of all the news reports and things that were coming in last fall about the results of the hurricanes, you know, at the time they were happening even, very little to nothing, actually, was said about people with disabilities. And we're not talking about blindness, we're talking alone, but just any disability was not covered. Never mind the fact that the people who are probably going to be impacted or among the people impacted the most would be those with disabilities.
Why would you say that that people with disabilities are likely to be impacted more than other population?
Well, there are a number of factors related to that, and I think that would relate home more than anything else. One of the things that we talk about with regard to a disability isn't that the biggest problem isn't the disability itself necessarily, so much as some of the societal barriers. And usually when you live somewhere or you're in a certain area, you've done your level best to get rid of some of the societal barriers and environmental barriers, things like transportation, because that's going to impact choices on where you live also, so that's going to impact housing. The service animal can impact housing. It shouldn't, but, you know, it can. Things like work is going to impact it. So all of the things like that. And so whenever you have something such as a natural disaster or, you know, or a terrorist attack, things like that, there's a very good chance that it isn't just your entire environment is going to be disrupted for people with disabilities and people without. And usually during these times of stress, those societal barriers are going to be even higher to overcome.
Last fall, in the hurricanes, you didn't have probably quite as hard a time in Daytona as we did down here. But as chairman of our Environmental Access Committee, did you hear any horror stories about the treatment of people with disabilities last fall?
Not really per se the way you're saying it. However, I have talked with some of our FCB members who went through the hurricanes in South Florida, who did, you know, comment to me about some extra problems they seem to have in terms of being able to get out, being able to get the things they needed, and being able to get assistance. And then, of course, both in terms of when I was talking with people directly and also at the conference, I heard several stories from different people with disabilities who had experienced some problems in terms of getting services during the hurricanes.
Yep. Down here, there were a couple of issues that surfaced. One of them was that in some areas, and actually this county wasn't as bad as some others, but in some counties there was a real question as to whether, for instance, blind people who were diabetic and who needed access to refrigeration and insulin during a time of emergency would in fact be accepted in special needs shelters. And also, of course, the issue of whether service animals would be allowed into special needs shelters. And of course, the other thing that seems to me to be a perennial problem, and I'll open it to both of you to talk about both of these issues, is there is an assumption that disabled people are helpless and that what they want to do at the time of an emergency is to evacuate as far and as fast as they can, and that often is not the case. So let me first ask Day if she has any comments on either of these two situations, either the problems of getting into shelters or the tendency of emergency preparedness people to want to abrogate the rights of people with disabilities.
First, I'd take care of the service animal thing. The official stance from the American Red Cross at their headquarters is that service animals are allowed into shelters. However, after making a few just phone calls of my own to some of the different local shelters, I did some while I was in California and while I was visiting out in Washington State, the little local shelters did not know that service animals were allowed. Some said no outright, and some would just, well, we don't know, but they would err on the side of not allowing the dog, which is part of the reason that one of our first brochures to come out was with regard to service animals. With regard to dealing with first responders, some of it is very much built on stereotypes, and it's 50-50 whether you get somebody who's going to say, let's get these poor helpless people out of here as fast as possible, including putting them into some of the medical shelters rather than realizing, you know, they could do just as well in a regular shelter, to the other point where the perception is, you know what, people with disabilities are collateral damage, and that is actual literal language from one of these people.
Well, and clearly there's some evidence in New Orleans that certainly severely disabled people who were living in nursing homes weren't dealt with appropriately. And at least if you believe the defendants in the current case, there actually was no way to evacuate them because the transportation infrastructure simply wasn't there. Doug, any comment on either of these two issues?
As a matter of fact, yes. I want to take the last thing you said first, transportation. Transportation is a critical problem, especially when it comes to evacuation. You're right. In New Orleans, there was a real problem that people couldn't get out. People in wheelchairs couldn't. There wasn't the accessible vehicles around. There just wasn't transportation. And I have a feeling for people who are visually impaired or blind, that is going to be a problem in many areas, especially in areas that don't have mass transportation. When it comes to evacuation, that's going to be a problem. On the other hand, you were talking about the problem people had in terms of getting into shelters, getting services, or the perception that some people had of people with disabilities being helpless. I know of three cases right here in Volusia County where these three people who had fairly severe disabilities were told by the shelter people, no, you go to the hospital, you're too severe. And he went to the hospital, and the hospital says, no, you don't have a critical need, you go to the shelter. As a result, these three people ended up either staying in their homes or spending money and going to a motel, which wasn't any safer than their home.
Let's talk, Day, a little bit, if we could, about what ACB has done in response to some of the findings that emerged out of last fall. You'd mentioned a couple of brochures. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about those and perhaps tell folks where they can get them?
One of the things that I'm actually pretty proud to say was the fact that a lot of the staff at the national office thought that emergency preparedness was something that we really needed to step up on. We saw Congress not moving fast enough. We saw other disability organizations scrambling trying to find things. And, you know, when we had Sharon in our office, I said, run through the numbers. How many of our members are in the affected areas? And she came back with a number of somewhere around 463, I think. And the idea is we needed to do something. And so we started with what we did best, which is Congress, and talking about some of the things, like more immediate things, like trying to increase and improve housing. We worked with the Blinded Veterans Association, and I think it was one of the spinal cord injury associations, about getting 4 truckloads of durable medical equipment headed down there. The biggest thing that we saw was the fact that there has been planning about emergency preparedness and people with disabilities ever since 9/11. And I think the thing that upset us the most was the fact that, you know what, we were a part of that. We've been a part of that planning. And what was upsetting is that last fall was a wake-up call that all of that planning and all of that talk didn't work. It had not trickled down to people on the ground. The local shelters didn't know that they had to accept service animals. People didn't know what kind of plans they needed. And some of the other organizations, like National Organization on Disability, and a couple of us had been working very hard with first responders on what people with disabilities needed. And I think one of the things we thought was, you know what, instead of everyone else telling us what we need to do, we need to sit down and look to the consumer and look to the individual. We are capable, we are independent, and there are things we can do to protect ourselves. Things like, you know what, I'm visually impaired. For me, you know, finding that the alternative exit is a lot more than just looking for the little red exit sign. And I've got to be willing and able and know to ask for that. You know, how many times do we go into a hotel at convention and remember to ask where the stairs are, because we usually take the elevator? Or if you're somebody who uses a walker or a wheelchair, would you remember to say, I should maybe know the dimensions and weight of this chair, because, you know what, it'd be a good idea to know if it fits through a doorway if I had to exit somewhere very quickly. And so our focus became on what kind of information can we get to the individual. And we ended up trying, let's see what we can do to create a brochure or a pamphlet, something that'll start working with the people on the ground. Let's let these other organizations who've been doing it work from the top down. We're going to work from the bottom up. We've got a lot of members who are capable out there. Let them talk to the first responders and say what they need on an individual basis, but also more on a local and regional basis. Florida is different from New York, which is different from Iowa, which is different from Seattle. So let's do that. We actually have just finished both of the brochures, and we're hoping to get them on the website soon, as in hopefully within a couple of weeks.
Cool. Why don't you describe each of the different brochures and give us a little bit of an idea of what each includes?
Sure. The first one that actually got completed was Emergency Preparedness for Your Service Animal or Pet. And the reason we did that first was because most of the things we'd been hearing a lot about had to do with service animals and them not being allowed in certain places. And all it is a simple, you know, it's a trifold brochure. It's done in I think it's 14-point font. And I know we're also going to work on having, I know we have Braille versions already done as well. And it's a simple question and answer form. Do I need emergency plans for my service animal or pet? You know, and then, you know, answer, yes. And then a little bit more about that. You know, what should I do first? Well, identification. Make sure your current service animal pet has current ID tags. And then it talks about, you know, what should be in my animal disaster kit. And it talks about basic things like medication or plastic bags for pickup or food and water. But it also covers things like, you know, are service animals allowed in shelters? Yes. Are there exceptions to that rule? you know, such as there are just two reasons. One is if the animal's out of control and the owner doesn't control it, or two, it poses a direct threat to the health and safety of others. We also thought about extending it to pets. One of the biggest things that we heard a lot about were people who refused to leave their homes because of their pets. A lot of our members have pets, too. A lot of us have retired guide dogs. That's also a consideration. And so we wanted to be as complete as possible, so we included that. And then things like, you know, very few disaster shelters allow pets because of health and safety regulations. But we also wanted to come up with answers, so it includes things like, okay, how can I care for my pet during a disaster? And we have things like, you know, make a list of pet-friendly places and hotels and talk to friends and relatives outside the area. We also quoted specific sections of the ADA, talking about that a service animal is any guide dog, signal dog trained to work with people with disabilities. We defined what public accommodation is based on the ADA. And we also put a note in there, you know, a service animal is not required to have any special certification or identification, because there's a lot of that going around as a question, like, well, how do I know it's real or not? And I'm like, you know what? I don't have my guide dog ID card. It's there, back there with my wallet and everything else I own. And at the back, we actually put down places to contact for more information. There's a lot of information out there. And when you see something that's 17 pages in standard print, let me tell you, you're looking at, you know, well over 30 pages in Braille. And that's a lot to read, and it's pretty overwhelming. Let me tell you, I got pretty overwhelmed by how much was out there. And so our goal was to try and keep it simple and focus on things that would be important. And so we decided to set on a three-ring analogy. And that's just the idea of, it's a simplified means of identifying and explaining disaster preparedness, because we wanted to encourage people to do step-by-step positive action. And so the idea is like three concentric rings, one inside the other. The centermost ring represents you as an individual. You know, what do you need? You know, during most emergencies, unless it's a burning building or an unsafe or damaged structure, most people are told to shelter in place and wait for further instructions from their local emergency management agency. And so the idea was to settle on, okay, what do I need? And that first step are the supplies that you should have prepared. The next ring out is kind of an expansion of that concept, and that's the idea of person and environment. Do you know what to do if you're at work or at a conference or at a convention? You know, where's the nearest exit? What will your family do if you're all separated? Who should you contact? And the outermost ring, the idea, it's a growing circle, represents the community and being active in the community. We've got first responders and planners and transportation departments and other officials who are all involved in this emergency management, and they're interested in knowing how best to serve the needs of people with disabilities. And so what this third ring represents is us, like blind individuals, offering our experience and expertise to kind of help with this planning process, because when we do that, we're actually serving our neighborhoods and our communities. And so we've got simple things like we talked about the basic things you'll find, like food and water and stuff, but we actually added some other things, and such as having a cane was work gloves. The Red Cross has a set of work gloves in what they suggest is their emergency kit. A lot of other places removed that from their collection because they didn't see it as important. You know, after auditory cues, touch is pretty much the most heavily relied upon sense for somebody who's visually impaired, and heavy work gloves and actually sturdy shoes can offer kind of a safety and security if we're going to be exploring an unfamiliar environment in addition to a cane. The other thing is format you can understand. Braille, large print, whatever's going to work for you. It's more than just buying your first aid kit. Open it up, go through it, figure out what's where, because those are things we need to know.
I actually think those brochures sound pretty useful, and I suspect that most folks will probably end up contacting the national office and demanding that they get their fair share of them relatively quickly. What you've also managed to do is to kind of provide us with a pretty good background on what both the specific issues that relate to service animals are and what at least one approach that we can take to emergency preparedness as individuals out there in the field. And so I guess in the context of those documents, Doug, Tell us a little bit about the conference that you went to and some of the issues that seemed to dominate that conference. And also, if you would, tell us a little bit about the sense that you got of the degree to which they felt like they had the answers and that disability preparedness was, in fact, in good shape.
Okay. Well, you have a lot of questions there. First of all, I want to thank Day because, as you know, Paul, when I was asked to go to this conference, it was like at the very last minute, more or less, and I did some searching online, and I frankly found it very difficult to find much information because, as it turned out, I was also asked to make a presentation on blindness at this conference, and I didn't have much information. So I gave Day a call, and she was able to email the information, which really helped me out to do the presentation. The conference was different, and just a real quick story, and I mentioned it earlier to some people here. The first day of the conference was 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. And the first day, Monday, we spent quite a bit of time talking about planning and the need for having a plan. And people generally assumed or felt that, hey, no problem, we have our plan, we know what we're going to do when it comes to an emergency. Well, Tuesday morning at 4 o'clock, the hotel's fire alarm went off, smoke alarm went off, and everyone had to evacuate. Well, I would say, with the exception of myself, just about everybody in the hotel had a problem, at least those of us at the conference, and it really wasn't any big deal. The only problem I had is people walking too slow. And something that Day said, and I realized it at the time, is that I really should have checked to see where the stairs were. Normally I do, but I didn't because of some problems that happened, and I never checked with stairs. Well, if anybody has stayed at an Embassy Suite hotel, one of the things I discovered is that when the alarms go off, when you're in an Embassy Suite, you hear all the alarms in the building because it's a big open atrium, and it made it very difficult for me to be able to hear what was going on. And it just so happened I lucked out that it was a lady there who was headed for the stairs, and I followed her, so we had no trouble going outside. Anyway, that day, after the emergency, we got back into the hotel, and we got into our sessions, and everyone who had said the day before about no problem, we got our plans, they decided that we don't have a plan, we'd better work on it. So I think it was a good wake-up call. Interesting side to that is that the hotel found out that it didn't have an emergency plan. So it was a wake-up call both to us and to the hotel.
Thanks, Doug. While we're talking about this, building evacuation plans are an interesting issue for all people with disabilities. And, Day, I think I would be correct in saying that certainly all public buildings and all Title III entities, too, ought to have some sort of emergency preparedness plan that includes how they're going to deal with folks with disabilities. And if they don't have one, is it appropriate for us as local chapters or as even individuals to say to those folks, gosh, you know, you really need to get it together? And if we decide that we want to do that, I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot with this, is there a specific location that we can look on the web perhaps to find some guidance on what kind of stuff ought to be involved in emergency preparedness, like places of refuge and that sort of thing?
Actually, yes, there is. I'd have to check to get the exact URL for you. But like I said, the planning on this has been going on since 9/11, and the Department of Labor, along with some of the other federal agencies, have put together what businesses would need to know and have, and numerous suggestions on what to do with employees, with visitors and people coming in with disabilities, and what would be the best things to include in part of their emergency plans.
excellent. And it is an appropriate question for people with disabilities to ask, and we are entitled to raise that issue. That is correct, yes?
Oh, encouraged. We're going to be the ones that have to do it. That Department of Labor website and the discussions on that have been going on for a while, but I think your average business in your local downtown don't know it, and a lot of them don't know what to do. And so what happens if you go in and say, you know what, this isn't something you need to consider doing, more than likely you're going to get caught saying, okay, what do we need to do? So I will try to get that URL and get that information out to people, because we're going to have to spearhead it, because we saw from the failure of this last fall that the information just isn't getting down to the local area.
Doug, tell us a little bit more about some of the presentations at the conference, and perhaps about some of the final recommendations that came out of it.
In terms of presentations, as I mentioned, I was at the last minute to give a presentation on visual impairment. The conference basically was set up by the Centers for Independent Living and Vocational Rehabilitation. There was very little, and one of the things that I was rather dismayed about is that there was very little thought given to people with sensory impairments, both deaf and visually impaired. So I gave a presentation on blindness, and Chris Wagner, who's president of the Florida Association of the Deaf, spoke about deaf and hard of hearing. There were very few people at our sessions, but the ones there were very interested. Anyway, in terms of some of the recommendations, one of the big recommendations, which I've been a believer in for a long time, is that the emergency people in the various areas are trying, but they don't know all the information, and they certainly don't know about disability. We talked about the need for people with disabilities to take responsibility for their own actions and to contact the emergency management people and set up a dialogue between the agencies, the management people, and people with disabilities to give them some of the information they need. There were probably 100 or 200 people there, and one of the things that really disturbed us is that there were very few emergency management people at this big conference. As it turned out, the Department of Homeland Security was having a required seminar in Orlando the same time as our thing was going on, and the emergency people went to that. I think they should have sent some people from their offices to our conference. One of the things that was stated at this conference is that there is a movement to develop a national or at least statewide interagency council dealing with disability that would coordinate efforts when it came to emergency preparedness and work with the management people to come up with a system. I think the long and short of what we talked about was the need to have communications and the need to work together and to share information. We did spend some time talking about service animals and pets, and it was a hot issue during the past 2 years. In terms of the presentations, we did spend a lot of time talking about the impact that various disabilities may have on a person's ability to respond to an emergency. But it seemed to come down to a lot of it is attitude, a lot of it is expectations, a lot of it is how the person responds, how that person deals with an emergency.
Thanks very much, Doug. I think that certainly helps us to get an idea of where we are and at least to a degree where we aren't. In terms of emergency preparedness. It sounds like we have an awfully long way to go. I'm about to open it up for questions or comments, but want to see if Day has any final things to add before I do that.
Just the quick thing of you're right, in that we've seen that there is a long way to go, and it's a little frustrating, but I think the other positive thing is the fact that this is a terrible, I said we have the opportunity now because they're going to listen. They have a failure hanging over their heads. They've got the pressure, and this is our chance to make them listen, and let's make the best of it that we can.
two other issues I do want to quickly mention that we discussed at the conference, one of which you kind of alluded to before, and that is the whole question of special needs shelters versus regular shelters and people with disabilities. And one of the statements made is that there is no reason for directing automatically a person with disabilities to a special needs shelter. It should be up to the individual if they feel they need extra help. The other one is the whole issue of registration. A non-disabled person does not have to register with emergency management. Therefore, it would be wrong for a person with disabilities to be forced to do so. However, those of us at the meeting kind of discussed that it would be a very good idea for those of us who may have specific needs to go ahead and voluntarily register with emergency management, because at the time of an emergency, they're busy and they will call the people that are on their list that may need some special attention. So we basically recommended that people do call emergency management and give their name and phone number, so in the case of emergency, they would be contacted.
Question or comment?
This is Gary Wood. Yes, I think that it's important for that to be prepared to have the radio on, TV, if there's no power to have transistorized equipment available, battery-operated. I think that what Dave was mentioning about a widening circle, you know, three rings. I think that that's very important, you know, going from what we need and then going outward to what others around us need and then the community in general, how we can help. And it seems like that's a important thing to do. And this thing in New Orleans, like some of these people, I don't know if they were disabled, but there was even some euthanasia going on. To me, I think that was tragic down there with some of those people. I think they probably were disabled, but it's unfortunate that that's happened, and I think that this is very important that we know all this, that we need to know. I mean, preparedness is a good thing, but Paul was right that we need to look at what happens afterwards, because some people may not be as prepared, and we need to save as many as we can.
Hi, this is Kristen Main here, everyone. I have a comment on emergency preparedness. I can remember back when I was in scouting a long time ago and learned about emergency preparedness and how important it is, like you said, you know, to know what to do in case, you know, of fire or things like that. You know, you really need to know. I mean, be in the know. For all persons need to be in the know. Because otherwise, if you do not know, then you're not going to know the right things to do and what to do when it happens right that second. So it's best to know, you know, what to do.
I think I understand what you're saying, Chris. This is Doug. I think what it comes down to is ignorance and fear. I think that the idea of the shelters are really, to me, are not much different than, like, the apartment suggestion you said, that some management of apartments don't want service animals in the apartments. I think in the same way, there are some people who run shelters who just are uneducated or unaware, don't understand how important that service animal is to the person. So I think it's just a question that we need to educate people about that.
Definitely. And I have another comment in that regard, and I'll let other people share the floor. As far as being educated, I happen to agree with you, Doug, because, you know, more people, like I said, they need to be in the know. Especially since a lot don't know it, I mean, I know a couple of people. Well, I used to work with them up here for computer access, and they've moved on to other jobs somewhere else. And they had service animals, and that's what they like, because they're their companion, and they prefer to have service animals. And I think that people need to start listening to each other. You know, when other people say, you know, I have a guide dog. Like, for example, if I were in that person's shoes, I would have said, I have a guide dog, and this is what I want. And, you know, I would tell them what I want, and, you know, that it's my companion, and it's what I prefer to use, and I really would like for that dog to come with me, you know, and stay with me, you know, because, I mean, if it makes sense to you all, it would be my pet, and I would be responsible for taking care of it and doing everything I need to do to take care of it. Now, and I think the other reason why they're not letting people bring animals into apartments, I just think that those people are not being very nice. They're not thinking or knowing what's right and wrong, and they're not letting them. And I just don't think that's right, you know. So
cool. Thanks, Chris. Other questions or comments?
Well, I had a situation when I was at I don't know whether it was at school or work, that they had a fire drill, and they wanted me to, I knew how to go down, but sometimes they wanted me to wait till other people went down so that they could help me get down. And, I mean, it was their rules, and probably, I don't know if it's a federal thing, but that's what it was. And then one thing that might be a little bit... I suppose some people might add some comic relief to it, but when I was working and the power went out, when I was working for the state, and I got along fine. I was able to get around the other people who weren't used to being without sight or without light would have a problem because I didn't need light.
Thanks, Gary. Other comments or questions?
I never did find out where I can get a copy of that brochure in Braille. I did see it on the email. I would like a Braille copy of it.
0%.
Where may I get that?
It will be available from the ACB National Office in a while, Karen. If you send Day an email, she'll certainly be responsible for sending something out to you. And I think that her email address is dalmohamed@acb.org. Is that right, Day?
That is correct. And like I said, we should hopefully have both of those ready to go in a couple of weeks. Just send me an email, and I will make sure that you get a copy of it.
Other questions from other folks or other disasters that perhaps we haven't talked about enough that people would like to raise some questions about?
Oh, one other comment I want to make. At the conference, we talked quite a bit of time, spent a lot of time talking about legislative issues, and I think it's an area we really need to touch on here. Day probably has a more up-to-date information on, I think it's called 2124 Day. It's introduced by Harkin. Regarding emergency preparedness, I know there are a number of things in that he is trying to push through to deal with disability and homeland security. And then different states like Florida have legislation that they're pushing. But one of the things I think it's very important, and I touched on it earlier, and that is the whole issue of emergency programming. We all are aware of television stations that when you're watching it goes beep, 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 beep to let you know there's a warning, but who the heck knows what it means. I really would like to recommend and urge people to support the descriptive video bills that are in Congress so that we can get that taken care of.
Yay, Doug, you just hit one of the biggest things that I really would like to see support for is 2124, which is Harkin's bill, does talk about emergency preparedness and the planning process and information and evacuation and transportation and housing. But our video description bills, those same little bills that ACB has been supporting for years that we're trying to get through Congress, does cover emergency information on the screen. We really want to get a study out. We really want to get it shown that this is something that is needed and is something that works. You know, to date, we have less than a dozen signatures on that, on those bills. And, you know, I'd like to see more. And one of the things I've been planning on challenging people, and it'll probably go out, on our phone system, the 1-800-424-8666 number for the Washington Connection, and an email is a challenge to members. Let's get 30 signatures in 30 days, you know, just as a start, to do this. Because we can't do it alone. We need everybody to pitch in.
Dave, why don't you give us, if you can remember them, the Senate and House bill numbers for the video description?
Sure. For video description, that's Senate Bill 900, which was sponsored by John McCain, and House Bill is H.R. 951, which is sponsored by Congressman Markey.
Excellent. So that's Senate Bill 900 and House Bill H.R. 951. And of course, the Harkin bill is a Senate bill. Other questions or comments?
Actually, I do have a quick one about the Harkin bill, and it's in our papers for legislative seminar, which are on the ACB website. One of the things about the Harkin bill is it offers some great things, and it really encourages people with disabilities to be a part in emergency preparedness, and it creates this entire, you know, disability coordinator under Homeland Security. It sounds like a great bill, except for one thing. There's no money in it. So how can you create someone who can do all this planning and get all these people involved when how are you going to pay this person's salary? Are they going to have a staff? Can they do anything? So without that kind of money, it's one of those kind of feel-good bills, so that's one of the cautions I wanted to put in there as well. And we mentioned that in the paper on the website that explains the bill in detail.
Cool. I think that it's actually important that we recognize that there are a lot of bills that end up getting passed by Congress. And even if money's incorporated into those bills, it's still a trick to get that money actually included in a budget by the current administration and then supported by Congress. So the legislative lesson, I think, is that we've got to be careful to recognize that getting a bill through is really only the first step in being sure that something actually results from getting that bill passed and implemented. Other questions or comments?
This is Gary Woody, and I'd like to say that to Dave and Doug that I think that this descriptive video thing, Bill, I think it should be a very hot-button issue. I think that that's important for the blind and disabled of the country.
I don't know where to put signatures on these things. You say you want more than 100 signatures.
0%.
But I don't know where to sign it. Otherwise, I would look into it.
Want the race on top speed? Let me know and I will connect. Has just signed in.
Thanks. Just let
0%.
Me know.
Karen, the signatures that we need are signatures from co-sponsors in the House and Senate. What we're asking members to do is to contact their local legislator and try to persuade him or her to become a co-sponsor of the video description bills. Since there seems to be a paucity of questions, let me throw a couple more at you two. One of the issues that I think surrounds emergency preparedness disabled participation and the degree to which people with disabilities have a good idea of what to ask for. I don't know if this is a problem in other places, but Disabled people are as varied a population as any other is. And there are an awful lot of people in the disability community who may be well-meaning, but particularly in terms of those who are prepared to get involved in emergency management kinds of issues, they tend to be people who will err on the side of wanting the community to do far more for people than with disabilities than many in the community would want. And I guess I'd like to ask both of you, how ought we, perhaps, as local chapters and state affiliates, to try to work to assure that the people that emergency management folks listen to are those who are reasonable, not the folks who are extreme, who will actually demand that every disabled person be put in a medical facility, for instance?
That's an interesting question. I wish I had an easy answer to that one. I would think the only way you could do that, and I've done that with Daytona Beach advisory board that we're trying to develop and some other things. I think part of it is to just try to get, I think you'd find the people who are demanding of attention probably are not going to be the kind of person that's kind of the staying power that's willing to get in and do the grunt work of working week after week after week to develop something. I wish I knew how we can be assured that the people who really have the best ideas are involved to participate. I think one of the things that we have to do is to get the management people themselves to be willing to listen and to be willing to work with, the representatives of different disability groups.
6%. One of the questions I've been wanting to raise at some point is, with the National Hurricane Center itself, what do they know or what are they doing?
0%.
We're getting their own paperwork sent out to us blind people.
Kara, there are systems that you can sign up for that will email you in the event of any emergency that is happening in your area. Some of these are set up by the federal government, and others are operated at the state and local level. It's difficult for me to tell you exactly which one is available to you in your area, but you'll almost certainly find that if you do a little bit of investigating, you can sign up for an email that will provide you with all of the alerts that relate to emergencies in your specific area. The National Hurricane Center here in Miami has a website that's actually pretty accessible, but they are not the entity that's responsible for getting information to us. That responsibility resides with local and state governments rather than with others, and they will typically use television, other things. Many states, Florida being one of them, have actually published emergency preparedness documents, which they've made available in accessible formats. And every hurricane season, there are new emergency preparedness supplements that are published in most hurricane-prone areas by newspapers under the sponsorship of various firms. Here, we've had pretty good success at ensuring that those supplements are made available in downloadable, readable files that people who are blind can access.
Another way to find things out, like if people have a NOAA weather radio, like I have one of those, and there's a tone that is emitted when if there's a tornado warning or different kinds of warnings, but now they sometimes I hear them say it's NOAA all hazards radio, but there are a lot of different hazards, but I do have a NOAA weather radio, and those are quite essential these days.
Okay. Other issues from folks who haven't so far spoken or comments, perhaps? Okay. I think that tonight we have established that there are a lot of questions and not nearly as many answers as we'd like. I think we've established that last fall it became clear to us and to many blind people in the affected areas that emergency preparedness is something that we don't have. Before we actually wind up tonight, let me ask Doug and Day if they have any final thoughts that they'd like to leave with our listeners. And I'll start with Doug.
Okay. I thought you'd be nice and go ladies first. I suppose that from all that I've learned from this and what we've talked about tonight, I think that, to me, the most important thing that I've gotten out of this experience is that the need for us to work together, to get involved, as you said before, to work with the first responders, whatever, the management people, to try to develop a good system where we are. And second to that, and maybe just as important, is we need to take responsibility for our own actions. If we assume that somebody else is going to take care of us, it's not going to happen. I think one of the things we discovered at the conference when we just sat down and just talked about what people did, one of the things we discovered is that most people really don't have a plan, really haven't thought about it. It's the kind of thing I think we need to do. It's kind of like at work or at school, you have the drills for emergencies or whatever it is. I think those of us as individuals need to consider that and come up with some ideas of how we want to handle various emergencies. They're probably the two primary things that we talked about at the conference. And, of course, add on to what both Day and I said earlier, we need to make sure that descriptive programming bill is passed and other legislative issues take part. Again, it comes down to being involved.
Day, do you have final thoughts?
Sure. Yeah, Doug stole my thunder. No, I think Doug really hit it on the head. We need to really step up to the plate here. They used to say, if you're not at the table, it means you're on the table. And you know what? That's not a place I'm real keen on being. And the other thing I think I'd like to stress is when people start thinking about emergency preparedness and you start hearing, people talk about it, there's a lot of information and it sounds kind of overwhelming sometimes. And so most people don't get around to their personal plan. And I think what I really like to tell people is start. Pick one thing. It could be as simple as, buying, a case of bottled water, sticking it behind your couch and forgetting about it. Or adding a first aid. Just one small step, such as when you're somewhere else, remembering to ask where the stairs are or where the emergency exit is, and doing it one step at a time, because a lot of times people just don't get around to it. I'll do that at some point or someday, and you know what? Someday's going to be here, and if you're not ready, we're going to be on the table, and that's not a good place to be. Again, I do encourage people to really try and help move some of that legislation. It's going to take phone calls from a lot of people to get them to do it. The only way to do it, like Doug said and reemphasized, and I can't emphasize enough, was the only way to do this is if we do it together.
Day and Doug, thank you very much for being here. I think there are three lessons that I'll take away from tonight. The first is I really like ACB's approach in their general brochure that puts us as people at the center and then asks us to take a look at the environment in which emergencies can happen, and then asks us to take a look at the community in which we live. I think that's probably as much as we as individuals can legitimately do to begin to be prepared for emergencies. But I think the chapters and affiliates need to go several steps further. And I think that the bottom line is that while emergency preparedness plans are made on a county-by-county level, we need to have state rules that mandate the inclusion of disability in all county plans, and we need to have federal laws that insist that the federal government uses the powers that it has to set up opportunities to develop and implement best practices that are developed from all over the country. So essentially, if emergency preparedness is to be a successfully implemented entity the next time a major disaster strikes, we need to have made a lot of changes, not only in the way our local, county, state, and federal government handles things, but in particular in the way that we handle things. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in this evening to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to encourage you to become involved in emergency preparedness and to tune in next week for Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.